Hello, and welcome to Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. We're the boyfriends. I'm Billy Ray.
And I'm Joel.
And today we're doing Season 6, Episode 10, Boom Crunch.
Yes.
We finally got to the disaster episode.
Yeah, a little bit light on the disaster.
Yeah, diet disaster.
Yeah, disaster max.
So in today's episode, I'm going to be breaking down and leading the episode and such, and Joel is going to give us his trivia. Have you got anything to start us off with?
I do, yes. Yeah. So this episode was directed by David Grossman, written by John Pardee and Joby Murphy, and the episode aired on December 6th, 2009. The title of the episode comes from a Stephen Sondheim musical song from Into the Woods, and it was written for the stage musical and it was performed during the previews in San Diego, but it was then adapted into a new song, which is Last Midnight for the Broadway run. And Sondheim has been quoted as saying that the song mystified audiences.
That's interesting.
So I thought I'd do some trivia on the guest stars. So Daphne Bix is played by Caroline Aaron, and she currently stars in the TV series The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, but has also been in films such as Sleepless in Seattle and Edward Scissorhands, and has guest starred in various shows such as Sex and the City, Two Broke Girls, and Malcolm in the Middle.
Yeah, I've definitely seen her in stuff before.
Jeff Bix is played by Dan Castellaneta. And if you've never heard of that name before, then what rock have you been living under, really? Yeah,
like, when did you grow up? What TV shows did you miss?
Yeah, so Dan voiced the genie in the Aladdin sequels and Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2. He was in Space Jam, Friends, The Office, but most people will know him as the voice of Homer Simpson since 1989, as well as other characters on The Simpsons such as Grandpa, Barney, Krusty the Clown, Sideshow Mel, Groundskeeper Willie, Mayor Crimby, and Hounds Molman.
Yeah, that's a talented voice actor.
It really is. So Dan's normal speaking voice has no similarity to Homer, and to perform Homer's voice, he has to lower his chin to his chest and is said to let his IQ go. So as contrast to Homer Simpson, Dan is a vegetarian and a teetotaler, and he also exercises regularly and practices Tai Chi. And after salary renegotiations in 2008, the voice actors received approximately $400,000 per episode of The Simpsons. And 3 years later, with Fox threatening to cancel the series unless production costs were cut, Dan and the other cast members accepted a 25% pay cut, down to $300,000 per episode.
Fair.
On this day, that week, on the week really, not even the day, so a major policy speech, South African President Jacob Zuma announces the country will treat all HIV positive babies and expand testing.
Nice.
Which is great, we love to hear it. The body of German-Austrian billionaire Friedrich Karl Flick, stolen from the grave in 2008 and held for ransom, is returned to his family.
What?
Yeah, I know.
Someone buried up, like, dug up the body?
Yep.
And used that as, wow.
As ransom, yeah.
Were there no children around?
No, why would you want to kidnap a child over a dead body?
Because they're alive.
Yeah, but you get no hassle from the dead body.
Yeah, and they probably smell just as bad, actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah, so Queen Elizabeth II of the United Kingdom firmly warns newspaper editors in a letter to cease publication of personal pictures of the British royal family after years of being hounded by paparazzi.
Hilarious.
Obviously, this is what, 14 years after the death of our Lord and Saviour Princess Diana? And I don't think that is even legitimate, because they've never stopped.
No, I mean, still to this day, the amount of stuff with Kate Middleton, Meghan Markle, the princes, it's still...
It's constant, and it never stopped.
Yeah, it is still constant vulture-esque harassment.
Yes. So, an archaeologist discovered evidence of mass cannibalism in Europe during the Neolithic period at a 7,000-year-old burial site in Germany.
Whoa. Shout out Lara Croft.
I know, right? The movie The Blind Side was at the top of the box office.
I haven't heard of it.
Doesn't that have Sandra Bullock?
Probably.
I think it's got Sandra
Jennifer
Bullock.
Jennifer Aniston, one of those.
One of those. And the United States number one song is still Empire State of Mind by Jay-Z featuring Alicia Keys. Mm-hmm. And the United Kingdom's number one song is Children in Need medley, Peter Kay's animated all-star band. And I don't even know what that song is.
Oh, they didn't actually write the song?
No, that's just all it says. Children in Need medley, Peter Kay's animated all-star band.
Oh, great.
Is that the one that's like, show me the way to Amarillo?
Maybe?
But yeah, that's all of my trivia for now.
Fantastic. So, previously, Bree got some evidence that she can use to blackmail Orson and get out of her marriage. Finally. Gabby and Lynette completely fell out. Yeah. Danny attempted suicide and told his real name to a nurse, who completely believed him and just went with it. And Catherine purposely harmed herself and called an ambulance.
Mm.
And we will see the repercussions of that today.
We will.
So we open with the Bixes, Daphne and Jeff, and they work for Bix Aerial Banners. Unfortunately, they're unhappy and she never stops complaining.
Mm.
One morning, he wonders when God will end his suffering, which he does while they're in the air in an aeroplane.
If your wife is this miserable and brings you so much suffering, why would you subject yourself to working with her? I'm putting yourself in a tiny plane. Like, I could not think of something worse.
Maybe he thought that if he said no, it would be worse.
Like, you just don't shit where you eat. Like, you don't mix work and personal.
So they argue, and Jeff tells her that he wants a divorce. And then when she says that she's going to ruin the company, Jeff begins to have a heart attack. The plane begins to lose altitude right above Wisteria Lane during a street party. A Christmas street party, by the way, because it's Christmas.
Right, it's disaster meets Christmas in this episode.
I know, they're here to ruin Christmas.
They are, and this woman is a real mood.
How so?
Because he's like, I'm going to divorce you, and she's like, I'm going to fucking ruin you. She's everything. I love this woman so much. She's everything I want to be when I'm like 60 odd.
She's got a real mean streak. Also, yeah. 60 odd?
I don't know how old she is.
God, I hope she doesn't listen to this.
I know. Just kidding, Caroline.
3 days earlier, Mary Alice talks about the best Christmas ever as everyone prepares for a Christmas street party, gigantic candy canes and all.
Mm.
Gabby and Lynette are arguing, as you could expect given the situation, and Bree says that whatever the problem is, they need to make up before Christmas caroling.
Yeah.
Gabby then tells everyone that Lynette is suing Carlos and that Lynette is pregnant, leading to a lot of confusion, a lot of, what? And an ambulance then shows up for Catherine as she comes out, and Catherine tells the police officers that Mike stabbed her.
Yeah, well, she sort of like whispered and then lazily pointed a finger at Mike.
Because she's so weak from being stabbed by Mike. She's and so then weak. Mike's just like, oh, you've got to be kidding me.
But it does look suspicious because everyone's gathered outside Catherine's, and then Mike runs over and he was like, well, I was just there 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Oh, Mike, girl, Mike's Mike.
Now, let's start this episode with the Bolans. So Danny has woken up again and is confused when the nurse Mona calls him Tyler, clarifying that he must have been dreaming up the name when he woke up because his name is Danny.
Yeah.
Mona refuses to let him see his mum, but promises soup.
Ooh.
We then see the Bolans arguing with a receptionist about insurance and how they have to have it. And this poor receptionist, the Bolans are the last people I'd want to have an argument with.
No, I know. They're really, like, aggressive with this poor receptionist.
Yeah. So Mona is in the background. Mona is the nurse that Danny woke up and said his name was Tyler to.
Yeah.
She takes them aside and says that she's noticed some things are off about them since they've moved to Wisteria Lane, and she guesses that they're in the witness protection program.
Yeah.
And they just lie and say that she's completely correct, but she can't tell anyone.
Danny, his reaction told Mona everything she needed to know when she was like, oh, I brought you some soup, Tyler, or whatever. And he's just like, well, no, I'm not Tyler. That must have just been, I must have been dreaming. Like, oh, no, what have you? Oh my God, Danny, learn to act.
Yeah, come on, Danny. And Mona, what's with the slight casual racism towards Italians?
Oh yeah, I know. She's like, well, once I knew you were Italian, I just went from there. What the fuck?
Yeah, then she starts saying like, are you involved with the five families or whatever? I was like, you see, this is why you don't get invited to people's weddings.
Like, I reckon not being invited to Susan's wedding is what caused Mona to behave the way that she does in this episode. I reckon that was the start of it. Susan started all of this.
Susan called her a dog with a bone, but I think she's just a dog.
Okay.
Later that night, Mona tells Danny that he's been released and she gives him a ride home, which I thought was a bit odd and inappropriate.
No, but they are neighbours.
That's true. I bet it is weird. But we find out it's just that she can tell him that she knows all about his family's situation.
Yeah.
For some reason, Danny can't use context clues to realise that she doesn't know what she's talking about, and he implies that his mother is a terrorist.
He doesn't imply it. He straight up says it.
Yeah, but Danny... context clues, active listening, listen to what she's saying, think about the words that she's saying. She doesn't know anything.
No, and then he says too much.
He then walks into the house and admits that he told Mona everything.
And do you reckon Angie and Nick ever get fed up of Danny walking through the door and saying, Mar, I screwed up? Like, he seems to do that a lot.
So good old Angie has to go outside and talk to her and fix the situation. She thanks Mona and implies that Danny isn't in the right headspace, and so basically he's just talking crap. And Mona admits that she hates her job, but she can't leave it because you need at least a year's expenses, and says that she wants 67 grand from Angie so that they can all be free.
See, this is where the woman is smart. This Karen. Karen's been waiting for something like this to fall into her lap. She knew instantly, the minute Angie was talking to her, she was like, I need 67,000. Girl's been doing the math.
I love that she had that figure in her head.
She has that exact figure in her head.
Even though it would have been funny if we got a shot of inside the car while Angie's walking out and she's doing it on a calculator. So Angie and Nick talk about the blackmail, and they have some emergency money aside, and maybe they can make up the rest with Angie's wedding ring. They don't look very happy, but they agree that it's probably the best thing to do.
Yeah, and 67,000 is a lot. I'd be freaking out too.
Yeah, I don't even know where I'd start.
No, neither do I. I don't think I'll ever have that amount of money at one time in my life.
So Angie, on the day of the disaster, gives Mona the money and the ring, but Mona is unhappy with the amount because it isn't enough.
Feels like such a small envelope for 67,000.
God, what a bitch.
And she's so gagged that they're doing it right on the street. She's there like, really? Right here?
And Mona worries because Angie could disappear at any moment before paying her off. She then says that she knows how Angie murdered someone, and Angie decides to tell her the story of what happened. But it cuts away, so we don't hear it.
No, we don't hear it.
But that's all we hear from for the Bolands until the disaster.
Yeah.
So, let's move on to Breen. In the Hodge household, Bree and Orson briefly speak about the Mike and Catherine situation before Bree says that she wants a divorce and shows him the photographs she's going to use to blackmail him. Yeah. Orson then admits that he was bluffing the whole time about sending her to jail and that he would never do that to her, but he is hurt by the fact that she would think that he would ever do it, and says he'll pack after breakfast.
I'm sorry, don't try and take the high road and gaslight her. He's like, do you really think I would do that, Brie? I could never do that. How could you think so lowly of me? Because you threatened it?
I mean, I know that I cut back to this moment a lot, but he did run someone over, so it's not really hard to think that he'd stick to his word.
No, exactly. I'm literally just, you can't sit there and make Brie feel like you're the injured party here. That's not cute.
Brie is making a call to Carl and arranging a meetup, ending it with, see you soon, my darling. Only for Orson to walk into the test kitchen right behind her without her even knowing. And he's heard he's heard the ending.
He's heard enough. And Orson's really having a bad day.
He really is. So he doesn't know it's Carl, but he does seem upset that she's moved on so quickly. He asks her not to tell anyone about her new relationship until after he's said goodbye to everyone at the Christmas party. And when she agrees to, he walks out. But we then unfortunately cut to Carl, who is talking with Daphne and Jeff from earlier and arranging an airplane banner message for the Christmas party, which will basically out their relationship and destroy Bree's promise to Orson.
Yeah.
He then gives his divorce lawyer card to Jeff because Jeff says he wants to divorce his wife.
Like, just a public proposal. Like, no, ew, disgusting. This is horrible. We've established this before on the podcast. I hate public proposals.
Now, it's around this time that, well, actually, it's a bit later on, but I didn't know when to put it in. The Bix are making their way to the aeroplane to deliver Carl's message, because it's during the day of the party, and they argue along the way, and we have a clip.
Hey, wait up. I want to go with you.
Can I have one moment of peace?
Our therapist said we need to do more stuff together.
I know. That's why I don't go to the therapist with you.
Oh, come on. Would it kill you to spend some time with the woman you love?
I don't know. Would you be upset if I brought her?
As long as she doesn't deflate in the plane.
Well, nice short little clip that we had there.
Yeah, I know. Just a little short one.
But they're the guests. And yeah, it is Dan.
It's
Castellanito.
Nice. It's nice to have Homer Simpson as a little clip.
You can't not have Homer Simpson.
No, exactly.
So, at the party, Carl tries to kiss Brie, but she's having none of it. Orson then walks over and angrily tells Carl that he knows that he's trying to represent Brie's divorce.
Yeah.
He then says that soliciting clients at a Christmas party is tacky before doing a walk-off. Carl then tells Brie about the aeroplane message and tries to call the pilots to stop the message after Brie says that that cannot happen based on the promise that she gave Orson. But unfortunately, he doesn't get through to them.
Yeah, they're already in the air.
Brie wants to tell Orson about the plane and the banner to try and soften the blow, but Carl offers to do so instead and takes him inside of Santa's grotto to talk to him privately. Carl tells him about being Bree's new boyfriend, very much to Orson's surprise, and they fight.
Right. The first punch was warranted, and it is nice that Carl allowed the first punch. But then the punches kept coming.
We also can't not talk about the fact that Austin hit Carl with a giant candy cane.
Yes.
Like, that was his weapon of choice.
That does need to be discussed.
I mean, in all fairness, there wasn't much else around.
No, well, they're in, like, a little Santa's grotto thing, aren't they? So
following the attack with the candy cane, Bree does go into the hut to see what all the commotion is and try and break up her childish men from fighting. Yeah. Now let's move on to Shujin. So Susan and Bob have gone to the hospital, although I've written Lee, but, you know, interchangeable boring side gaze and all that.
Yeah.
And Bob is telling Susan that she has to pretend to be Catherine's friend for Mike's sake, which Susan begrudgingly agrees with when she goes into the room.
Yeah, and Bob can't really blame Susan for feeling like this.
No, she's a freaking loony.
Like, Catherine's lost her marbles. It's the worst thing Catherine's ever done. And Susan's husband is now about to go to jail for attempted murder.
Yeah.
When he's already got a record. So that's not really going to work well in his favour. So you can't really blame Susan for being like, yeah, I'm going to smash this phase over her head.
It's a very good point because it was manslaughter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
She then walks into the room and says that she's concerned about Catherine. Although Catherine says that everyone should be concerned for Susan since her husband is a maniac.
She's really trying to rub it in. She's like, you should be the one that everyone's feeling sorry for. I mean, your husband turned out to be a maniac.
Catherine says that the knife wound and the 7 stitches prove otherwise, though. And after Susan pleads with Catherine not to have Mike sent to jail, Catherine kind of sinks further into her lies or her delusion. Susan then asks Bob how she can get Catherine committed, but apparently only family members can do this. So she decides to call Dylan from the hospital phone, pretending to be the nurse who has a very interesting accent.
Yeah.
And we have a clip.
Excuse me. I was just with my friend Catherine in 607, and she was talking to her daughter, and she wanted me to follow up about something. Do you have that number?
Dylan Mayfair?
Yes. Would you mind dialing that number?
Certainly.
Hello. This is Dr. Brewster calling from Fairview General. I understand that you were just speaking with your mother. Right. I do feel, given her condition, it is important for you to come here if you can. Lovely. See you soon.
I don't know what the fuck that accent was supposed to be, but it certainly wasn't the nurse.
Not a clue. For a bit of context, I cut a little bit in the middle to make the clip, you know, feasibly shortened. But there was a gap to imply that the nurse did walk away.
Oh, yeah.
She didn't just, like, start doing that in front of the nurse.
Because the nurses are like, Dylan Mayfair. And then Susan's there like, right, well, it's like a terrible British accent from Susan.
Oh, was it meant to be British?
I think it was meant to be British.
We don't sound like that.
She needs to be, I don't really like saying this, but she needs to be committed. She needs to just have some time away from everything.
Do you know what she needs?
What?
She needs a cup of tea.
She does. She needs a good old cuppa, a couple of bickies.
Maybe a sauna. Sweat it out, girl.
Yeah.
She needs a break. Have a kick.
Have a kick.
Later that night, Dylan has arrived on Wisteria Lane. Hi, Dylan. Welcome back.
Yeah, I know. Kind of love that we got the little cameo from Dylan. That's nice.
Yeah. And she gives Susan a good old telling off.
Yeah.
Seemingly thinking that Susan is harassing Mike and her mother and that she ruined their wedding and that she's crazy. So Susan then takes this moment to show Dylan her wedding photos and prove that Catherine is the delusional one and convinces Dylan to help her.
Right, the gag when Dylan's like, give it up, he's married to my mother. And then everyone's like, what?
Yeah.
Wait, what?
From an outsider's perspective, I would not believe Catherine, though.
Well, I put the exact opposite. Like, why has Dylan not questioned this? Because if I was Catherine's daughter, I'd be wondering where the hell my wedding invite was. Why I've not been invited to visit them both. Like, where has it all been? Because
I mean, I know that the wedding that they were going to have was so last moment anyway, but it was in Vegas, wasn't it?
It wasn't Vegas, yeah.
So maybe that's why.
Oh, so maybe that is why, actually. Maybe Catherine just didn't tell Dylan they broke up.
Yeah.
She just continued with the lie. And it probably started because Catherine just was so heartbroken about the breakup that just that little lie to Dylan just made it feel better.
Would not work in the modern day when everyone takes pictures on their mobile phones at weddings.
Yeah.
Dylan would be like, where's the photos?
Yeah, where's the Instagram? Come on, mum.
What the hell?
Why aren't you gramming it?
Dylan goes to visit Catherine in the hospital, who apologises for Mike not being able to greet her when she got home as he is away on business.
Yeah, and this poor girl was definitely not expecting to visit and send her mother to an institution.
Oh yeah, away on business. Do plumbers go away on business?
Yeah, he has like a plumbing seminar.
Yeah, I guess so. The big old pipe conference.
Yeah, you never know.
Oh, the pipe conference. But Dylan admits that she knows what's happening with Mike and that she knows that Susan is married to Mike. She asks Catherine if she stabbed herself, and Catherine, who is crying at this point and it's getting very sad, tells her that Susan trapped Mike and justifies her actions, or she tries to in her own mind anyway. A nurse then walks in with Susan and it gets very dramatic. Catherine tries to do a runoff before being restrained by the hospital staff in front of Susan and Dylan. And we end on a very somber note with Catherine saying, "I asked you not to come."
And she says it twice, and the first time really breaks my heart.
The second time broke my heart even more. I was like, I thought it was broken and I thought, oh no, it's fine, because it just broke again.
No, the nurse ruins the second one for me. No offense.
I was about to mention that. Why did the nurse with the stupid accent have to ruin the moment?
Please, Mrs. Mayfair, we're trying to help you. Like, no, what the fuck? Stop talking. You're making it worse.
I know. It's like a scene from the Addams Family. Like, what the hell?
But Catherine says it twice. She says it in the room with Dylan. And the first time just really breaks my heart. I mean, Dylan's there like, did you stab yourself? The breaking of the heart right there when I was like, oh, fuck me.
That's because Dainey Dillon is acting. She could act her way out of chains.
Yeah, I know. You know. So good. Although I do not agree with the direction that they've taken Catherine's character, I do think Dana has done a fantastic job.
Oh, yeah. She saw that script, and as a professional, she was like, you know what? I'm just going to give it everything.
Yeah, she's like, fine. I'll run with it. Let's run with it. Let's go.
Like, this script is dumb, but I'm going to run that character. Like, I'm going to go for it. I thought it would be even more dramatic. I mean, it is a disaster episode. She could have, like, ripped a needle out of her arm that was, like, giving her liquids and, like, slashed someone or something.
Oh, my God. I mean, she really could have, but the disaster's for the lane, not for the hospital.
Would have been great though, wouldn't it?
It would have been really good if they'd like merged the two together. But
what a great way to kill off Dylan.
But maybe that would have been like a too big of a bite.
It would have been too irredeemable for the character. The fans wouldn't have liked it.
What, for her killing her own fake daughter that she found in Romania?
I mean, I would have loved it. But you wouldn't be able to justify bringing her back ever. You know. Now, on to Lynette and Gabby, which is the last story. Lynette is cutting up some coupons with Penny, who asks if they are poor, and Lynette says, only financially. And Tom tells Lynette that he can't get his tuition refunded. So they begin to panic about the fact that they're going to run out of money in a few weeks. Lynette then apologises for all the mistakes that she's made to Tom, and Tom says that at least they might get some money from the lawsuit if they win, but this doesn't really make Lynette feel much better since it is against their friends.
Hmm.
So they decided that maybe they should give the apologising thing a try. And end the whole fiasco.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe we should try apologising, I guess. I've never really done that before.
Apologising is in.
Yeah.
Revenge is out.
Like, it's sweet that Lynette apologised to Tom for all of this, but it's not all her fault.
Oh, no, of course it's not all her fault. Although, with all of the stuff that people say about Lynette being horrible to Tom, like, you know, fans, Felicity Huffman...
Yeah.
I think it's quite nice to look at a moment like this and be like, Lynette admits when she's wrong and she apologises.
Yeah.
So.
But Lynette's daughter Penny is too young to be sitting with her and clipping coupons and hearing her bitch about the finances.
True. But like, it's humbling.
A child that young doesn't need to hear this.
But even if you don't, kids pick up on it.
Also, Penny, ravioli in a can is vile.
Oh yeah, that was a child moment, which I really loved, when she's like, being poor is fun, we can eat things from the can.
Yeah, she's like, ravioli in a can, I like poor people food.
Bruv, it's vile. You had that sexy Italian man cook you some proper ravioli.
But she was a baby then.
Oh yeah,
she was a toddler.
More please.
She probably doesn't really remember that.
Oh yeah, 5-year time jump, sorry.
Yeah.
So we then cut to Gabby and Carlos, and he tells her that Lynette's case is pretty strong, and if it goes to trial, he'll probably lose the company.
Carlos could lose his job for being the worst CEO ever. Like, that's such a big fat bummer.
I know. Carlos's villain arc was quite apt, considering that Gabby's the one that forced him into doing it, and he said, I don't want to do it because I know what I become when I become a big businessman.
That's true.
And it's such a shame that that's never brought up. It could have been like a really nice reflective moment for them.
It did get brought up at one point where Gabby originally wanted Carlos to work all day and then come home and like be a parent and do the necessary things. And Carlos was just like, I took this job because of you. You knew what it would do to us. C'est la vie.
It's a shame it never comes up for this though.
Yeah.
Lynette then knocks on the door, only for Gabby to slam it in her face.
Yeah, which I get, I bet must be so satisfying.
Yeah, she's like, I know I'm probably the last person you'll speak to right now. And she's like, yeah, slam.
Slam.
I've never slammed the door in someone's face. I hope I get the chance to one day.
I know. I really think it would be fun.
I'll do it the next time I get a parcel.
No, that poor delivery person.
I'm joking. I would never do that to Leonard. So, we're now at the party, and Lynette keeps trying to make up with Gabby, but she's having absolutely none of it. We get the Christmas caroling moment, and they begin to argue during the singing. They then begin acting very childish as Gabby steals Lynette's Christmas hat, and they sort of bicker and tussle, and they ended up knocking over Brie. And obviously, this is a very bad outcome because you don't want to piss off Brie, especially during something that she's been organising.
Yeah, she's really getting the short straw in this moment. Also, it's worth mentioning that during this entire episode, we've just had nothing but clips of Lee bitching about how he's not been included in the Jingle Bells.
Yeah.
Because he's not a woman. And so they're the Jingle Bells, not the Jingle Balls.
And then they're up there singing, he's like, whores.
Yeah, I know. And he's there like, oh my God, it's so not the same without me and what have you. So just thought I mentioned it because, well,
I do think it's a ridiculous exclusion, but we are in a very white conservative street.
Yeah, I know.
So it's no surprise.
No, of course not.
So yes, this is a very bad outcome because they pissed off Brie. But luckily for them, all she does is fire them from singing and tells them to sort it out. Which they don't. They do not sort it out.
No, they really don't sort it out.
But you know, for considering that you knocked down Brie, it could have gone a lot worse for you ladies. And that's where their story ends. So now let's move on to the ending and the disaster of the disaster episode. Tom and Parker notice the plane flying very low. The plane then begins to land on Wisteria Lane, and one of the wings hits Mona as it drives by, so absolutely killing her.
Yeah, Mona is dead, and that shot is awful.
The one where it cuts to her feet, which disappear, but then the envelope lands.
Yeah.
But that's just good, because hopefully Angie picks up the envelope.
Yeah, but it's just an awful shot. Like, that effect of Mona being lifted off the ground just didn't seem realistic. Like, I've never seen someone been hit by a wing of a plane, so I can't exactly speak from experience, but it just felt really fake. Which it obviously is fake, but it's just not meant to look it.
It was a bit Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
And that was the only person that knows about the Boland story, other than the Bolands, and now she's dead.
Yeah.
So we will not be hearing about their past for a little while. But we almost got there, and the writers are doing this on purpose. They're like, oh, you almost got it. Put it back. You've still got a whole season to go.
Yeah. But we'll come back to that at the very end once we've discussed the story.
So the plane continues its way towards the party, and everyone runs off. Celia is about to get hit by the plane, with Gabby screaming in fear, but luckily Lynette manages to run up and save her, literally just in the nick of time.
And there is no way in hell Lynette grabbed Celia and got out of the way of the plane in time, because in the one shot, the plane was so close to Lynette, and then in the next shot, Lynette's nowhere to be seen.
So the episode ends as the plane hits Santa's grotto and destroys a whole load of shit. And Mary Alice says that everyone wanted the best Christmas ever, but something went horribly wrong. She says that of those that survived, everyone would remember this as the day they would try to forget. Which is a really weird sentence. Everyone would remember it as the day they would try to forget.
Oh yeah.
I was like, yeah, I get it, but weird wording. And for those that didn't, this Christmas would simply be their last.
But whose Christmas was last? Because Brie, Orson and Carl are in the house.
Yes, we cut to a shot of some people looking over at Santa's grotto, and all you see is a bloody hand leaning out of the window. And it's definitely a man hand.
I was going to say it's Brie's.
I
thought it looked quite a dainty hand.
It was a dainty pose, but the hand itself I thought was a man's hand.
Maybe. Maybe Brie's just got a serious case of man hand.
Yeah, I mean, to the hand model, if you are a woman, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, really, really sorry. I'm calling it, but Bree's really, really being rude to you.
But yeah, all three of them were in there. We know that Bree's not dead.
Yeah.
Because the show's not Game of Thrones.
Brie might be dead. This is the disaster episode that apparently killed the most people. Minus the fire one, I'm going to say, even though this doesn't say that, because the fire killed quite a few people, but they were like...
Didn't it only kill three people?
Day players. They were like day players. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we know it killed Mona, and Mona's... we know it killed the guy with the heart. It killed Jeff in the plane with a heart attack, and it killed one person in possibly two in Santa's Grotto.
So it killed Jeff and Daphne,
mm-hmm.
Mona.
Oh, is Daphne definitely dead?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Well, plane crash.
Yeah, but I thought she might be okay.
No, Jeff and Daphne are both dead.
Oh, poor Daphne.
Jeff was dead before the disaster. So Jeff and Daphne,
Mona,
there is now another two people that we don't know about yet.
Mm. So it could be one, it could be two. Is that the highest kill count? Five?
Yes.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, because Boom only had like three.
The fire was Dr. Hellier or Hella. Dr. Hella.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh wait, no, it must have been the fire. I mean, oh, but day players, like you said, so yeah, it's the most named characters that died.
Yeah, they weren't like legitimate characters that had speaking parts.
Yeah, so far the fire had the biggest kill count in general.
Yeah, because the tornado
has the biggest. Tornado killed one.
Yeah, Ida.
No, two. It also killed Gabby's husband.
Yes, it did.
You know, so far this is my third favorite disaster episode.
Yeah, this is a little light on the disaster.
And to be honest, I feel like Boom and the tornado episode are quite close. But I think Boom might win out. And it's mainly because of Carolyn Bigsby.
The Boom is still by far my favorite. Oh, Bang, not Boom.
Oh, sorry.
Bang is still by far my favorite Desperate Housewives episode, like of all time. It's the GOAT. But Bang is the GOAT of Desperate Housewives.
What's that?
Greatest of all time.
Oh, thank you. I always hear it and I never know.
Yeah, GOAT is greatest of all time. And Bang is the GOAT of Desperates.
I do agree. The Tornado one is so close, though. The disaster is horrendous. The acting is fantastic. The acting is fear.
Yeah, incredible. Incredible, the Tornado one. So I do agree this would probably be the first one. This beats the fire episode.
I think that's going to go down as the worst one of all time. But I guess we'll have to find out through the rest of the season, the series.
This is also the second time Susan and Mike have not been affected by the disaster.
Oh, yeah, because they weren't in the fire, were they?
No, Mike was. Mike and Susan were in the fire. I don't think they were in the tornado.
No, they were at the hospital.
They were. And this marks Dylan's final appearance.
Oh, so we could have had her slashed.
Yeah, I know. They really could have killed her off.
Damn.
But they didn't. This was Dylan's final appearance.
Fair. Okay, well, say lovey.
Lovey.
Nice, solid joke.
Thoughts on the disaster episode in general?
As an episode in general, it was absolutely fine. And the disaster part, which was so short-lived, was pretty good.
Mm.
It's a shame that the disaster episode was... The disaster part was so small.
Yeah.
So tell me your thoughts.
I felt like they used this disaster episode to get out of cul-de-sacs in the story. Like they backed themselves into a corner story-wise for an awful lot of the stories that were ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't think of a way to legitimately get out of them. So they created this disaster episode to try and sort it.
In all fairness, don't they all do that?
No.
I mean, they killed off Gabby's husband, the villain. So when Carlos and Gabby wanted to be together and they killed off Nora and Carolyn Bigsby.
Yeah, but it didn't feel so forced in that one. This one felt
Whenever
forced.
They don't know how to get rid of the villains, they do a disaster episode.
Yeah, right. This one felt forced.
They always feel like, especially this one is the most though, but they all feel like soft reboots in the season.
They do, yeah.
They're like, okay, well, we've lost every storyline and mystery that's built up to... We've lost every storyline and big moment leading up to this moment, and we have to kind of start again.
Yeah. This is what Desperate Housewives is good for. They're very good at new beginnings, and that's what they...
Just to point out, that was not a criticism, because some things you don't want to drag on for the entire season.
No, and it's nice to just push the reset button once in a while and be like, okay, disaster episode, reset, let's go. What's new? Because now we've had a mid-season disaster, what's the trauma that's going to come from that? Who's got trauma? Who's lost someone? It opens up new storylines. It opens up new emotions for characters and so on. You know, who's going to die in that?
Yeah, and quite frankly, I don't think, as juicy and nice as it was for a short time, I don't think people want to see too much of Lynette and Gabby fighting in such a big, serious manner, like with lawsuits and stuff, because if it gets too messy, you can't really come back from it.
No.
So and you then have you've to stop broken. It at some point.
Yeah, exactly. And so this felt like a very
it's better than if they were just like, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry too. No.
Yeah, which is what they did in the last episode.
Yeah.
And then it didn't last and they fucked it. And that was the reason why. And it worked well that way because it was like, oh, really? Like, it's just this simple apology. Oh, no, wait. Mm. It's developed even more. But like you say, they can't build it too far. Otherwise, there's no coming back from it.
Mm. So that is where the episode ends. And We're now going to move on to the next segment where Joel's going to give us the gayest and the straightest moment. Starting with the gayest moment, what you got?
So my award for gayest moment goes to Lee for taking his moment and joining the Jingle Bells when Gabby rips off her hat and storms off.
Yeah, that's pretty fitting. Good for him.
He's like, he just sees the hat on the floor and he's like, it's my moment.
And you know what? They were being such bitches about it, so you do you.
Then. Yeah, you get up on that stage. You do you. You sing that song with your dusky alto.
Yeah. And then what do you have for straightest moment?
My award for straightest moment goes to Carl.
Oh.
Just like, it's just the whole like public proposal thing, it just rubs me the wrong way. Like, assuming that because Brie wants romance, that means a large crowd of people must be involved. Like, it's just, it's a very average straight person not understanding romance thing.
I mean, there's also the fact that, for the love of God, she hasn't told anyone about you and she's still married.
Yeah.
Why would you think it's a good idea to put it in a banner in the sky?
Yeah, I know. Where's the communication?
Oh my God.
This ain't going to work if you can't even communicate.
But that's so Carl.
But I did that one for Carl because I really couldn't think of anything else.
Yeah.
So those are my awards. So bravo to Lee and Carl. And now we move on to B's awards for best and worst parent. So who do you have for the best parent?
My award for, and I've got both today.
Oh, good.
Best parent of the episode.
I gave it to Lynette, obviously.
Okay, why obviously?
She saved a child.
Okay, fair. Well, yeah, no, I'm just, like you say obviously, like, but I just want to make sure that your obvious and my obvious are the same.
Oh yeah, because her and Penny were bonding over coupons.
Yeah, right.
just because she saved Celia, and she's still so kind to those kids, even when she's arguing with their parents.
Right, like best parent because she offers to take Celia to go see Santa. So yeah, bravo Lynette, who do you have for the worst?
My award for the worst parent?
Worst parent of the episode.
Catherine.
For lying to Dylan.
For just all of the lies. And also for trying to slash her with the needle in my mind.
She didn't. Also, worst parent for trying to get a kid's dad sent to prison for no reason.
Yeah, that was pretty rough.
Yeah.
Considering that she was MJ's co-parent.
Yeah, and she does claim to care about him.
Mm.
So, yeah, okay, sorry, Catherine.
Yeah, bravo, bravo, fucking bravo to everyone with awards this episode.
To all of them, yeah.
Well done. If anyone has any questions, queries, comments and theories, where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at boyfriendsreview, and you can find us on Twitter at BFSreview.
We also have email, which is boyfriendsreview@outlook.com, and our friend Louis does the artwork, and you can find him at Doc Red Monk Designs, where there's a link to his Etsy page, and he does do commissions, and you can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to this through your podcast provider. So that was Season 6, Episode 10, Boom Crunch. We'll be back in your ears next time with Season 6, Episode 11, If.
Well, see you there, guys.
See you then.
Bye.
Bye.